Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today are Bill Vannevar and Livia Drapkin Vannevar, who are marking the 40th anniversary of the Vannevar Caravan, a performing and teaching arts organization that focuses on world culture and art, including dance and music of various genres. The Vannevar Caravan has toured across the world, often pursuing programs that celebrate peace and understanding. Bill Vannevar and Livia Drapkin Vannevar, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you. We love WAMC.
Yes, it's our best friend.
And we know that, and we love you guys. And that starts the question about the movie fades to gauze, and we say, where did it all begin, and why?
Oh, where did it all begin? It began in 1971 at a Balkan dance festival at Columbia. I had been a folk singer on the road. I was accompanying the Penny Whistlers.
I remember them well, yeah.
And Livia was a student in her last year at NYU School of the Arts and Dance, which is now Tisch. And we met, and we
started working together almost immediately. And we had this combined love of traditional dance and music, and also this very deep creative side, using the traditions of the world as a springboard for our own creative work. So Bill began to compose music for my choreography, and I think our first concert was in 1972 at the Washington Square Methodist Church as part of Izzy Young's Folklore Center presentations.
Boy, do I remember him.
Yes.
Were you married then, by the time you started it, or did that come later?
That came 6 years later.
Yeah, we got married in 1977.
And it's not the usual thing, is it, this caravan idea? Where'd the name caravan come up?
Well, it actually started by being called the Coming Together Festival of Dance and Music, which was the title of the first concert, and that is our corporate name as a nonprofit. But Coming Together Festival of Dance and Music, Inc., is really long and was hard for people to... But then somebody, one of the dancers in our company said, why don't you just call it the Vannevar Caravan? It kind of has a nice flow, like Vannevar, Caravannevar, Caravannevar, you know?
Indeed.
And on and on.
Well, it's also a caravan is a kind of catch-all. It's a traveling entity with a lot of flavor, so... The hallmarks of what we do has to do with variety. And we perform music and dance from many, many cultures, and we travel, so.
How did you make a buck?
Well, we actually were an interesting organization, even though we're supported very wonderfully for the past 33 years by the New York State Council on the Arts. Dance program and also arts education program. Most of our income comes from working in the schools, doing our arts education programs, and performing in concerts. That's most, and of course now with the economy being the way it is, we are incredibly grateful to the individual and foundation sponsors that sponsor us.
I take it it's much easier now than it was when you first got started.
In terms of what?
Money.
Well, no, because the economy is an interesting thing. I mean, so many theaters have lost their funding. So many schools and school districts have lost their funding that...
The arts always get in the neck first.
The arts, absolutely. And as I said, you know, we're very grateful for the PTOs that have picked up, the foundations that have picked up the tab, as it were. But it's always a struggle. Almost everything we do, we have to fundraise for.
So who are your heroes?
Well, when I was 14 years old, I went to a left-wing camp in Michigan, and there was Pete Seeger and Big Bill Brunzi.
Like the rest of us.
Yes. And boy, and, you know, we're close with Pete now, and Big Bill's still my favorite of all the blues singers. And over the years, I guess my favorite male singer would be Martin Carthy. My favorite female singer would be Billie Holiday. And I love Peggy. I mean, Peggy, Mike, and Pete have all been tremendous influences on my life. And in the dance world, Dennis Shawn and
yes,
and
well, for me, I have to start by saying that Fred Burke, who was considered the father of Israeli dance in America, was my mentor since I was 14 years old, and I was in his company in New York City at the 92nd Street Y until I left the city in when I was 23. And so I would say he and also Ruth St. Denis and Ted Shawn, who were the mother and father of modern dance in America, mm-hmm. and Jane Sherman, who was their youngest company member when they toured the Orient, became very close with the company and set 10 Dennis Shawn pieces on our company. It's in our, and that's in our repertoire. And I have to say Jose Limon, because, oh my goodness, he and Doris Humphrey were probably my favorite choreographers and very influential on the work that I do.
Well, you know, you can always play the banjo till you drop. But dancers have a shelf life, don't they?
Yes and no. I mean, at this point, I have to announce that I have a new hip. and you know, even though, I mean, I can dance now, but I really almost prefer doing choreography, directing, and watching these beautiful young dancers come into our lives and grow and flourish and, you know, help them create themselves.
And if I asked you, Olivia, to tell us your style of dance, is it, what do you do?
I would say it's based in rhythm. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is percussive. We do a lot of clogging. Based on folk motifs. So you'll see many different folk motifs often mixed into a variety of styles. So I'd say rhythmic, folk, and modern. That's a good mix. And it's pretty particular to Vannevar Karavan.
And that's pretty much what my composition is like. I mean, my composing is a mixture of using different folk elements, even bringing in performers and mixing them with orchestration, you know, performers from other traditions. For instance, with the work we did 15 years ago, Peniel, I brought a Bulgarian singer to sing in Hebrew with the orchestra. And for the Polly Vaughn piece that we're premiering currently, I'm bringing up an Appalachian singer, a traditional Appalachian singer, to sing with the orchestra.
Where'd you find the singer?
Through my network of friends, and you know, I had to find somebody who could read a bit and understand how to do what I need done with an orchestra. You can't improvise too much.
You know,
when
I looked at you guys and I heard your story initially, I was fascinated because, and when I asked you about your heroes. Because, as you know, Woody Guthrie was married to a very famous dancer, somebody from the Graham Company, I believe. And I know you guys are folkies, so there's quite a little tradition there, isn't there? Does it ever occur to you?
Oh, my God.
Absolutely. You opened a big door there.
Good.
I think I'll just tell you, in 1996, we did a concert of Pete Seeger's music at the Bardavon Opera House. And Nora Guthrie, who's one of my best friends, and Harold Leventhal were in the audience. And they came backstage and they said, "We have to do a program with Woody's music and dance." And I knew Marjorie very well because Nora and I went to NYU together. And she was actually in our first concert at Washington Square Methodist Church. But I knew Marjorie very well. And so we began creating a piece called that is a full evening's work. It's called Pastures of Plenty. And it's a tribute to Woody in dance and music. And Marjorie is very much in there because each piece is done in a different style and it's all interpreted through dance.
Wow. So it runs the gamut from swing to mariachi to bluegrass.
But you guys are collaborators. Woody was a singer who didn't go to work in his pajamas every day and say, "I'm going to create something now together. We're going to create something together." So how do you work? In other words, you know, you're both a choreographer, you're writing music, Bill. Everybody who is creative tries to figure out how the other guys do it so they can emulate them. How do you do it?
I would say that every project has a different approach. When I was in art school painting, every time I'd start a different painting, I would approach it in a different way. It's really interesting how each different piece of music kind of requests a different process.
Actually, I've been trying to be a lot more pedantic, down to earth, if that's the better way to put it. I want to know how you do your work. I want to know whether or not conceptually, but how you do it. Do you have a set routine?
So I think the best way to explain that or to shed some light on it is to look at the latest project, so you can kind of get an idea. So creating a new piece based on The Legend of Polly Vaughn. The first thing was that Bill collected all different versions of Polly Vaughn and listened to it for like a month. And two of us listened together to try to find the best theme melody. And then
finding the best lyrics, because there are hundreds and hundreds of versions of the song. And then talking to mythologists about their interpretation of the whole story.
And so Bill basically wrote the music, but I was part of the process the whole time, listening to, you know, how the scenes changed and where the different melodies came in and the lengths of the certain sections that are in there. And then listening to the music, getting, you know, a CD of the MIDI version of it. Then I begin to stage it, block it. And then coming into the studio with the dancers, I choreograph based on, number one, who the dancers are in front of me, because they each have their own amazing abilities. And then Bill is with me in the studio helping to explain the rhythms and the music, and also looking, you know, that doesn't work there. This note needs to be emphasized with movement. So this is a real collaboration in every step of the way.
So if I'm writing two columns a week, which I do, I get up at the same time every week and get in front of the computer, often in the middle of the night, because, you know, I wake up and say, okay, I have an idea. Now, how about you guys? I mean, do you have a specific way to do this?
Well, I'm laughing because in this particular process, I mean, I would spend 6 to 8 hours a day writing, but my main creative time was when I was sleeping, and I would wake up in the middle of the night. One night I woke up 7 times and dictated into my cell phone my ideas, and then I went back to sleep. I'd wake up a half hour later. My best ideas come when I'm driving or in the shower, or that's kind of how it works.
You mentioned, folks, that you've traveled around the world.
Yeah.
Now, we know that Pete, during the McCarthy days and post-McCarthy days, basically couldn't get an even break from the State Department or anybody else. And some other folk singers were sort of put on the road by the State Department because other countries wanted this. I mean, it's clear you have a somewhat progressive view of life. How have you fared?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the very beginning of our career in the 70s, we were asked by the State Department to tour in Greece, Italy, Cyprus, and Tunisia. I think that they sent us to those places because they wanted to build American reputation and esteem. And the fact that we also, on our programs of American music, we also sang some Greek music. We also helped them create the whole program notes in Greek. We even learned Greek so that we introduced our concerts in that way, and also in Italy, the same thing. So, you know, being what I call cultural ambassadors of goodwill has been part of what we've done since the very beginning. We just came back from Sweden this year and India, and we're still doing the same thing. So, we bring the dance that we do, we bring almost like the hope of the world through the eyes of the American people, because we are American, and help to create help to fuel the global society, the global community. I don't know if I can explain it any better, but
well, I also think I was asking whether the State Department considered you to be non-toxic. Clearly, clearly Pete was.
Yes.
To them, but it was at an earlier time.
That's right. It was an earlier time, and I'm sure that they understood our sort of progressive bent.
By 1970, the heat was off.
Right, but also don't think of the State Department or the embassies overseas as one thing, because there are many different people working in those organizations.
Yeah, but
who
when
have
it
their
was
own.
Pete, there was one.
Oh, well, they had no choice from their perspective. That's true.
I mean, I think that the direction was clear. So let's talk, Bill and Livia, about the caravan itself. You've mentioned, Livia, when the dancers come in and putting them on with their individual talents. And, Bill, you've mentioned the orchestra. So when you add all of this up, that's quite a little budget, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it's all a struggle. You know, I don't think any artist really...
So who's on the ticket all the time? The two of you.
The two of us.
Is there a general manager or something like that?
Yes, we have someone who works with us as an administrative director, like a general manager.
Yeah.
And we have an office staff of wonderful three part-time people who are just incredible. And I think the people who work with us, you know, the Vannevar Caravan is live music and dance, which also makes it a unique company, because most dance companies are just dance company with recorded music.
Sure.
So we have, you know, Toby Stover and Evan Stover are with us playing piano and fiddle, and they've been with us for 37 years.
No, are they piece workers or are they on old time?
Toby's on full time.
Yeah,
because she also teaches in the schools with us. But I have
a number of fiddlers that we work with,
right,
for instance. And also, it depends on the program. If it's the Pastures of Plenty show, we don't use a piano; we use a guitarist. So that's a whole other.
And some dancers and, like I said, musicians have been with us for many, many years, and some are new, and some we bring in for special projects.
So let me put my WAMC chief executive hat on, because what keeps me up at night is the money.
Yes.
You know, making sure we have enough to do this.
Right.
So if one were to look up your, go to GuideStar and find out what this not-for-profit corporation costs to run, what would it be?
Well, I'd say, you know, about $300,000 a year.
That's very little money.
That's very little. But at the same time, we're always having to fundraise. We have to fundraise for every project that we do. And we were always having to fundraise. If you went to our website, there's a button that says Donate Now. So people have an opportunity to participate in the company in that way.
Now, one of the reasons they should donate, it seems to me, is because of the wonderful work you do in the schools. You're quite right in bringing up the idea that, obviously, the first people that get it in the neck are the arts people, and as schools are reducing their budgets, which many of them just have to now because of the way in which the state has treated them and other exigencies. So tell us a little bit more specifically about what you do in the schools.
Okay, well, probably the main thing that we're known for in the schools for the past 25 years is going in to a school or a school district, working with teachers and a grade level, usually third, fourth, second grade in the elementary school system, and creating a world dance and music festival with them. So each class becomes another country.
Wow.
We teach them a dance and usually a song, and their whole classroom also fills with their artwork and culture. You walk into their classroom itself and you feel like you're in another country. The parents get involved, they make costumes, the music teachers get involved, art, all the special area teachers get involved, and the whole school then becomes this festival. And then we get together at the very end and culminate with a World Dance and Music Festival. And the template for that was built in Beacon and built with Pete, actually. He's part of that every year.
Do you remember how that happened? I mean, did you sit around a table at his place and come up with an idea?
No, actually, it happened with a woman named Anne Marie Faust, who currently works at the Bardavon in their administrative office. She was at that time the arts coordinator in the city and the Beacon City School District. And she had this idea of creating a festival with the third graders who study regions of the world. And so she approached the Dutchess County Council on the Arts and said, do you have any groups that or any person that does this, and then they referred her to us.
Do you contract with the school districts? Is that how it works? That, you know, the school district says, yes, we'd like to have you, or do you have to raise outside money in order to do it, or both?
Well, for the first 20 years, we contracted with the school district itself, and that goes with all the school districts. If for Beacon particularly, they completely cut their budget for the arts. And so they had created years ago an arts foundation. One of the assistant superintendent, Lloyd Jaeger, had created an arts foundation that had been dormant, but now it was time to revitalize it. And the Arts Foundation does all different way, you know, all different things to raise money. So people who want to support the Calico Ball in Beacon, which that's what it's called there, they would give to the Beacon Arts Foundation, and we contract with them. But we have to always be sure that it's something that the teachers and the superintendent want, because you can't just contract with any outside organization.
And that's hard work. I mean, somebody's got to go in and meet with these people and make the pitch and make the ask and do all of that.
Yes.
And sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. Sometimes you don't get it. So I guess I want to ask about Natalie Merchant, refer to her, our Natalie as well as our Pete.
Yes.
She loves you guys. How did that all come about?
Well, I taught world dance and music and American dance and music at Bard College for 8 years. And Natalie was my student of 1 year, and we became friends. And then with her daughter, it dances with our
after-school program, which is our institute. But I think what happened, really a very poignant incident was that Bill had a heart attack, and the community was getting together to do a fundraiser. And Pete had come forth and said, is there anything that I can do? And Chris Silver at the Bardavan said, yes, we're taking over Elster Performing Arts Center. This was 6 years ago. And if Pete can
Bardavan
give you...
Bardavan took over.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Bardavan took over. And if Pete can give you a date, that would be our first concert. So Pete said, you know, May 12th. And then I think Natalie wrote and said, is there anything I can do? And we asked her if she could be on the concert there. And so she was on that concert. And the most beautiful thing, Alan, is that, oh, my God, she sang To Sir With Love, which was so touching. And then, you know, she came to see one of our Woody Guthrie shows, Pastures of Plenty. And I think she also really loved Caravan Kids Company. We have a company of young people. Ages 9 to 16, and she just fell in love with the kids' company as well. And when her daughter now is growing up, and she's always wanted her daughter to study with us, and so she does.
She's the most generous person. I mean,
she totally
she's right
is.
Up there with Pete and so many of the other groups.
Yes, she's a very involved parent as well.
What's the worst thing that has happened to you guys while you've been doing this? And for those who are just tuning in, we're listening to Bill Vannevar and Livia Drapkin Vannevar, and they're describing the evolution of the fabulous Vannevar Caravan. So every one of us has a story about something that went wrong somewhere along the line. Can you guys think of something?
Well, I mean, just on a logistics level, one time we were driving down to the airport with the company on our way to North Carolina to do two concerts, and it was torrential rain and backed up traffic, and we missed our flights, and we had to miss the gig. I think it was the first and only gig we've ever missed. Same thing happened in Greece. We were scheduled by the State Department to perform in the two sides of Cyprus, the Turkish section and the Greek section. And really fortunately, it was, again, terrible weather, and we missed the first concert, which was in the Turkish occupied section, and we could only do the Greek one. And all of our Greek friends said that if we had done the Turkish side, we would have been shot the next day in the Greek side. I mean, that's how volatile the situation was there.
Been there. done it and had a feeling that, you know, this is really very tough stuff, but you were willing to do it. Had anybody explained it to you that there was a risk?
No, we didn't. We weren't aware of
we
that.
We weren't not that. Aware that we were, no, not at all. We had bodyguards, but the risk of having done, of being in both situations didn't occur to us until after the fact, and we had missed the first concert.
I just want to interject that we were recently in Sweden and performing there, and we did our own concert, but we also participated in a benefit concert for the people of West Papua New Guinea who were undergoing horrific genocide. And the leader of the resistance was there. So, I mean, here's somebody whose life is in danger constantly, you know, so I don't feel that.
How was that? I mean, how was it? Did you feel emotional when you talked to him or when he?
Oh, my God, yes. It's like meeting somebody like Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
He's just an incredibly humble person.
And dedicated.
And
but the good thing is that we succeeded in raising a lot of money and awareness in Sweden, and we're able to give him these funds towards the cause of freeing West Papua.
So, Bill, how old are you now?
67.
Yeah.
No, I'm 68, right? 68.
We're about the same age. I'm a little older. So tell me, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Philly.
Really?
Yep. And I was part of the whole, there was, every Sunday I'd go to the Gilded Cage Coffee House. The smoke was, I wouldn't even be able to see you. And we had round robins, folk singing every Sunday. And that was kind of, you know, after the camp that I mentioned.
Yes, sir.
Circle Pines, being at the Gilded Cage every Sunday and singing traditional songs. Folk songs.
So do you miss those days?
Yes. I do miss them. I miss the 60s too, you know.
What's happened to folk music?
Oh, I think it's, what do they call it? What did Mark Twain say? Reports of my demise are premature.
Yeah.
It's not as big as it was commercially in the 60s. But there are many people involved with traditional singing. We've done Pine Woods Camp, where everybody there is interested in ballads. And I mean, one of my favorite things to do in my whole life is just to sit around listening and sharing songs unaccompanied, no instruments, old ballads and songs. And that's wonderful. So there are hundreds of people all over the country that are very involved with traditional music and Appalachian fiddling and all that has blossomed. Balkan dancing, I was very involved with that in the 60s. It's not quite as big as it was, but now Balkan dancing has this added thing of bringing in live musicians, real Bulgarian players and people who play those instruments. And there's much more live music now than there was. So it's just morphed.
Well, but there was more political content, wasn't there? Back in the 60s and 70s.
Yes, definitely you could say that the political element, that social element, it's not, when I go on a march, for instance, they mostly have shouting and calling. We don't march down singing the old freedom songs and the political songs that we used to. It's not really part of that whole scene anymore.
So you had a heart attack. Tell us about that.
It was kind of from out of nowhere.
You been taking care of yourself? I mean, what do you
mean? Yeah, I think Olivia felt I was not.
He's
doing
too
well.
Much candy.
And one night I got dizzy and I couldn't sit down. I said, something's wrong with me, and I faint. You know, I don't remember anything after that.
You fainted.
I fainted, and then when I woke up in the hospital. I had flatlined 4 times, by the way.
Really?
And then I woke up and Livia said to me, Bill, you've had a heart attack. Doctors say you're going to probably be okay. And you have a new mitral valve made out of pig.
Yeah.
And I was all intubated. I couldn't talk, but my mouth's... Oh, and they were wondering whether I had mental function because they weren't sure because of the flatlining. And I mouthed the word trafe.
Mm. Yeah, oh, that's great.
Then I said, Bill's back.
Yeah. And then I was in the hospital for 2 months, basically.
Livia, what do you remember of that time?
It was pretty scary. It was, you know, we weren't sure if something was really happening that night, that he had the heart attack. We weren't sure if I mean, he actually didn't faint. He may not have a memory of it, but he didn't faint. He was just had to lie down in bed, and we just, I said, Bill, do you want me to call 911? He said, I don't know. I said, I know. I'm calling 911.
Sure, why not?
And so we took him to the hospital and in the ambulance, and then everything looked like he was going to be okay, and then he flatlined, and they had to rush him down to Westchester Medical.
What were you thinking during that whole process?
I was thinking, like, straight ahead. Oh, the first thought is, I'm not ready for this. That was my first thought.
Too soon.
This is too soon. Not ready for this. That was my actually the first thought that was in my head while I was looking at him. And I called one of my friends, Karen Pardini, who's like my go-to person in emergencies, medical emergencies. And she said, she made me describe all the things that were happening. And she said, Livia, he's having a heart attack right now. I had already called 911. Just prepare yourself. That's what's happening right now. So, you know, when I got down to Westchester, I waited in the emergency room, and the first person I called was Nora Guthrie, because she lived 15 minutes away, and
They often say that, by the way. I don't want to interrupt you.
What?
The way you judge whether you have a best friend is, who would you call at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, and I said, what are you doing? She said, nothing. What's up? I said, can you come over? I'm in the emergency room, waiting room at Westchester Medical. She would not let me drive for a week. I stayed with her. She, you know, took me back and forth to the hospital. I stayed with her for 3 weeks, and until Bill was really totally out of the woods.
Yeah. What advice would you give to anybody else who goes through that?
Well, it's really just have to jump the track. Like, you're going along in your life, and then you see what is important, and you just jump the track to what is important and what is right in front of you, and to also open up to friends and allow them to come in and support you. Because we had this thing called Caring Bridge, which was the most wonderful website where people could write in. They didn't have to be calling every 2 seconds, which would have been very stressful. And every day I would bring Bill a batch of his letters from Caring Bridge. He would say, did you bring them? Did you bring them? And this way people could all participate in the healing. And the caregiver needs a lot of healing, too. Needs a lot of support.
Indeed. So you guys,
I gained a great deal of respect and love for nurses,
yes.
I have to tell you. I think they're heroes.
Me too. I've always felt that, you know, the doctors are important, but they look in once a day or twice a day and say, how you doing? But that the nurses are the prime caregivers in a hospital situation. I think you're right. So did you guys ever think about giving up this wonderful Vannevar caravan as this was happening?
As this was happening?
Yeah, as the heart attack was happening.
As the heart attack was happening, you have to understand, Alan, that we were supposed to leave to go on tour to Texas 2 days later.
Yeah.
So the first thing
thank God it happened here, right?
As opposed to in Texas? Absolutely.
As opposed to on the way to Texas on an airplane.
God.
And this, that, yeah.
You know what? I never thought about that, yeah. I have to say. So, you know, I was on the phone with one of our fiddlers, Andy Tierstein, and I said, I told him what happened. Can you drop everything and take Bill's place? He said, absolutely. Everybody just picked up whatever pieces needed to be picked up, and the company went on tour to Texas without the two of us.
And they had to do all my lines?
They had to do all your lines. They had to do everything, and they did an incredible job. And this is really funny. David Burns was playing guitar with us, and we said to him, can you fill in for Bill? Can you and Andy, like, fill in? He said, oh, that's no problem. I learned every single thing from the album. I learned every single lick from the album. So everybody was ready to go. And we didn't have to give up that, because there were enough people to just totally take the reins and go with the Vannevar caravan horse.
We are talking to Bill Vannevar and Livia Drapkin Vannevar. who are marking the 40th anniversary of the Vannevar Caravan, a performing and teaching arts organization that focuses on world culture and art. You know, as a professor, every once in a while, you know, I get some tears around my eyes when somebody calls me and tells me what I've allegedly done for them, you know, how important it is. You guys have any stories like that?
What's really amazing, Alan, unbeknownst to us, when we first started teaching in the Hudson Valley, you know, we started with the little ones, the 4 and 5 year olds, with just creative movement, and then moving on and on. Many of them stayed with us into their teens, and that was when we started our first teen company, and the teen company then became the company. And we keep seeing this flow through of dancers, particularly, who are coming through the company and now in their 30s. And they've been so gracious in terms of being appreciative for what they've gotten. You know, I used to say, you won't appreciate me now, but you'll appreciate me when you grow up.
Well, that's true of the performers who've grown up with us. Then there are the other performers who we take on, who are full-blown. I mean, we have one guy who was the star of the touring show of Riverdance, another who was danced with us, who's one of the best flamenco dancers in America, and many stories like that. And to those people, they get to break out of their confined area and try new things and bring their own way of expressing things. And they love the fact that we allow them to have their
specialty
within our context.
Yeah. It's a mutual honoring of each other. So whenever we're on the road, which everybody will say is their favorite thing to do, even Amy Fraden, who sings with
well,
us.
Sure.
Yes, and she sings with us in our Pastures of Plenty show. She loves being on the road with us because it's really like a traveling family. We're such a tight community. And anybody who comes in for the first time is just welcomed in with open arms, and they love being part of the backstage and onstage aspects.
It's funny. I consider being on the road the most relaxing part of my life. It's funny. I think to some people it's stressful, but we're all rehearsed. We've done the show a bunch of times. You do a little bit of teching in the new theater, and then you're free. You can watch reruns of X-Files, whatever. You know.
Okay, so here's a provocative question.
Okay.
And I want you to be as honest about this as possible. Does anything or anyone ever get you angry? Can you remember an incident in which somebody made you mad?
You mean one of our people,
Well, in some ways, you're in charge as you travel, and therefore can be somebody who can be a pain in the rump, or there can be somebody who externally comes in and tries to rain on your parade. Those are what I was looking for, actually.
Well, I don't think I should mention her name, but we did a tour several years ago, a whole tour that was booked, and we were never paid. So that can make us quite angry.
That could do it. How'd you handle it?
We were only one group. I mean, we were down 30,000 for that tour, but there were groups that were in her stable,
yeah.
I guess is the word, that were out $500,000.
Well, do you ever see her?
No, not at all. She had taken all the money that she had gotten from the sponsors, from the theaters,
yeah.
And she took all of that money and invested it in two shows that failed. So when we got to the theaters, we didn't know because we always get paid after, so
sure.
We didn't know we weren't getting paid, and the theaters didn't know that their money had been taken and invested other places. So everybody was honestly going through the tour. That was really awful, and we're still paying for it. We still have, you know, credit card bills that were from that time. I mean, some people...
It's like paying off a college education.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But it was just a terrible thing. I think for me, one time we had a dancer who decided she would only do the shows she felt like doing.
Yeah.
And she was one of our best...
Yeah.
Performers.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we had to say bye-bye.
Yeah, yeah. Were there words?
You know, Bill and I come from the conscious loving
sure.
tradition, which is, you know, that wonderful work of Gay and Kathleen Hendricks. And you really, if you say how you feel right when you feel it and you own your feelings, all that other stuff doesn't really build up. So that's why this is a really, that's a hard question for me. I don't believe in exploding, that's the answer to dealing with anger.
You know, you guys mentioned one of my heroes before, who was Harold Leventhal.
Oh, yeah. Loved him.
Who passed now, and who, you know, I did an hour with at his little office. He looked like Yoda.
And
appearing over his desk. And he could get angry. I mean, you know, I remember saying to him once, well, so-and-so says that, you know, they had nothing to do with throwing Pete under the bus, you know, during the thing. And Harold said, well, he's not telling the truth or something like that, you know. And Pete says he's not angry. He said, well, I am.
Well, that's I guess I put that in the category of wrath in a way. I mean, in that kind of anger is more of in a social context. You know what I mean?
No.
It's more on behalf of a cause or other people or something like that. I feel it's a little different than interpersonal reaction.
Well, I could take lessons from all of you.
Well, I don't know.
I don't know about that.
The truth is, Alan,
we're not perfect.
The Vannevar Caravan has been around for 40 years now. I'm sure that there were times that we got angry, you know, but I'm not. I can't tell you. I mean, those are the two pointed ones that I can think of. We're totally human, you know.
So you said, Bill, before that he could do your lines. Is there a sort of set format for each of these appearances?
Yeah, I mean, our Pastors of Plenty show that's the Woody Guthrie show, is totally scripted. I mean, there are moments where we allow for informality, but each song has its own. I mean, I play six instruments myself in the show. So in order for me to change and tune and everything, it has to be all worked out. Exactly. So we have a moment for Amy to quote John Steinbeck and for me to talk as Woody. Sometimes I'm kind of being Woody. Livia's introduces the children's part of the show. It's all kind of scripted, and we can play with it a little bit. But so they just had to know all our lines from that.
The beauty of Woody Guthrie, of course, was that he was both profound and irascible. And, you know, he would make stuff up. The beauty of, everybody knows Arlo, and we love Arlo here at WAMC, and been great to us. But Nora is, of course, the keeper of the flame.
That's right.
And so how does that work out from your observations? I mean, has she kept the flame successfully?
She has done an amazing job. I think we always joke that Woody's looking down and, you know, he's still working. He's still working. She's helped to create this archives that's, you know, currently being established in Mount Kisco, where their offices are.
And where we have a new station. Yes,
that's right.
Go ahead.
And she and the archives are beautifully kept and just wonderfully built over the years. She has also invited many singer-songwriters to take the lyrics that have been found that don't have melodies and then be able to write their own melodies over them and created albums. I mean, she's prolific. I mean,
and all the klezmer stuff.
The klezmatics did a great job. Billy Bragg, the latest one with Rob Wasserman, Note of Hope is a beautiful album. And Bill has two pieces on our album, Pastures of Plenty, that he found in the archives that were two of Woody's songs as well.
You know, Olivia, when you were describing all your heroes in dance, Roselle and I, of course, live in the Berkshires, and we go to Jacob's Pillow all the time.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm saying, check, check, check. These are the great heroes of the great tradition of Jacob's Pillow. So what have you guys done with Jacob's Pillow?
Oh, that's great. This is such a nice story. The first time we appeared at Jacob's Pillow was in 1981. Mm-hmm. And they brought us in to do our Appalachian and Southern medley, which was based on clogging, but it had kind of story and song and ballad. It was about a 20-minute piece. And not even a year before that, we were doing a benefit for the Bardavon Opera House in Poughkeepsie. And Jane Sherman was on the program with some slide, Denishawn slides, and she was the youngest member of the Denishawn Company in the 1920s. She saw us perform. We saw her, and we both just fell in love with each other. We said, Jane, we want to visit you. We want to get to know you. Where do you live? She said, I live in New Paltz. We said, well, we live in New Paltz. And she said, come over to my house. I have an idea. And she had this idea of setting Ted Shawn's Boston Fancy 1854 on our company, which is a dance for four couples that they toured all over the Orient in the mid-1920s. And I said, well, you know, we're going to be at Jacob's Pillow this summer. Maybe they would like that piece as well. And they did. They thought that was a great idea. So we did both Appalachian and Southern Medley and Ted Shawn's Boston Fancy. The next year was 1982, and that was the Pillow's 50th anniversary. So Jane created for that all five American sketches. So we were at the Pillow in 1981-82. Then we were back there in 1990 doing our full Denishawn program with the Denishawn Repertory Company. And we took that show to the Biennale in France, in Lyon, because they were doing a whole 3 weeks called The American Story. And they brought over 18 companies. So we were one of the companies to go over and do the Denishawn work.
And our own work as well.
And then we were back there in 92. We brought Pastures of Plenty there, I think, in 2000. And then recently, we were back at the Pillow in 2010, closing their season with a new piece called Earthbeat, A Journey, which was based on world dance and music, featuring some of the dancers that we spoke about, you know, who were from river dance and flamenco and capoeira. We have a wonderful capoeirista from Brazil.
It's a fabulous, fabulous place, isn't it?
It's amazing.
And you got to really hand it to Ella Baff.
She's amazing.
Done such a good job of pulling them out of the red.
Yes.
You know, and making that a growing concern. You know, my respect for artists, it's not only for their art, but for their ability to make it and not have to close up shop. And
yeah.
She really has been fabulous. So Pete sings, Kiss is Sweeter Than Wine, you know, I had a lot of kids, Trouble and Pain, but I'd do it again. Would you?
Definitely. In fact, it's an interesting question now that we're in our 60s, you know, do we continue the Vannevar Caravan past Bill and Livia, you know, and that's, I feel like what the Vannevar Caravan has established over the past 40 years is something way bigger than the two of us. Yes, very inspired by the two of us, and we've dreamed into it, and many people over the years have entered into the dream. But what we've established now could go on if people want to continue.
I'm not sure we'll know until we're spirits looking down and checking out what's happening.
Because people ask me this all the time. They say, well, you know, you're 70 years old. What happens when you go? Who will take over? And yesterday we were at a little bit of a discussion with somebody who's doing a marvelous thing in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, taking the old church and making it into a cultural place, and the St. James Church. And, you know, they said, well, we want to build it in such a way. These are two very giving and probably well-heeled people who are saying, but we want to design an exit strategy. We want to design an exit strategy for ourselves. And I keep thinking, well, you know, I said, that's easy to say. I find it very hard to do that in terms of your great talents. You really have done a magnificent job with this. So how do you make that thing work? How do you make that go? An exit strategy.
Well, we haven't made the exit strategy yet, but we have put out...
Not yet.
No, but we have put out feelers to our dancers and musicians if they would like to not only continue working with us, but work with us in a deeper way. For instance, the work that the Vannevar Caravan does in the schools is a very big part of what we believe education should be more.
Sure.
Like. It's totally experiential, relevant, bringing together curriculum connections and giving the children this sense of joy and connection to the rest of the world. So there are many people in our company who are coming up in the ranks and working with us in the schools who believe that that's true. And they're finding their own voices within the container of the company, which is so beautiful to me. And I'm telling you, Alan, I did not expect that when we first started. It's become something else. The kind of community that we're creating constantly, not only within our own company, but within the places that we visit, whether it's a school, whether it's a theater, it's bigger. It's bigger than I thought it would be.
I just wanted to add a caveat to that. One thing that I think is somewhat unique about, not that we don't know other people that are also like this, but Livia and I have a lot of experience in the field, you might say. We've been in Greek villages. I learned clog dancing in England, in northern England, from an 80-year-old guy. We've not all of our material comes that way. We've been through the Appalachians. Many of our dancers and members of our company learn what they do of that from us. And it's only a few people that we work with that have had experiences in the field. For instance, we have Ramona Staffeld, who's been in the swing dance world and worked,
with Frankie Manning
and has a mentor from that milieu. So I think that's one thing that we have that it's not necessarily
transferable.
You kind of have to. Well, it doesn't even matter what aspect of what I'm calling the field it is, but I feel that more of our dancers, I would like to see them get out there and have those experiences with the traditions in their element.
Well, you know, also they did that in India.
Yes,
recently.
That's right. That's a good first step.
Yeah, and they actually sought to do this.
In Rajasthan.
They were in Rajasthan. We sent four dancers on a project with Big Medicine Charitable
and
Trust.
And you weren't there.
And
that's
we weren't
right.
there.
And they did it. Yep.
And they did it. Not only did they perform and teach 101 people there, but they also studied Tarathali, which is the Rajasthani gypsy form of dance.
Well, I could go on for hours with both of you. You're wonderful. And our guests have been Bill Vannevar and Livia Drapkin-Vannevar, who are marking the 40th anniversary of the Vannevar Caravan. There's more online at vannevarcaravan.org. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you,
Thank
Alan,
you,
for
Alan.
Having us. Yes.
Fall asleep, you weary hobo. And let the times drift slowly by. Can't you hear the steel rails humming?
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at WAMC.org.
Now I know police can cause trouble. They have caused trouble everywhere. But when you die, you go to heaven, and there'll be no policemen there. Slowly by. Can't you hear those steel rails humming?